Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, bishops from England and Wales tackle some pressing moral issues as they seek ways of witnessing to the faith in an increasingly secular context. Catholics and Orthodox move one step closer to reunification with a new document on papal primacy. But first, Pope Benedict urges solidarity for the people of Bangladesh, struggling to cope with the worst cyclone in years. Welcome to the programme. The deaths and destruction caused by the cyclone in Bangladesh were in Pope Benedict's prayers this Sunday as he called for international solidarity with the millions left starving and homeless by the disaster. At least 3,000 people are known to have died since the cyclone struck the southwest of the country last week. My colleague Lydia O'Kane takes a closer look at the Pope's appeal for the people of Bangladesh, as well as his words of support for those working towards a total ban on the use of deadly landmines.
Nei giorni scorsi un tremendo ciclone ha colpito il sud del Bangladesh, causando numerosissime vittime e gravi distruzioni.
Pope Benedict XVI made the appeal after his Sunday Angelus and urged continued international solidarity to help the survivors of Tropical Cyclone Cedar, adding that he was offering prayers for the dead.
Espressione del mio profondo cordoglio alle famiglie e all'intera nazione a me tanto cara.
The Pope also made mention of the fact that a conference of signatories to the 1997 UN Convention prohibiting the use, production, stockpiling and transfer of anti-personnel mines was getting underway in Jordan. In light of this, he called for the complete eradication of landmines, saying, "From my heart, I express my hope that the conference is successful so that these weapons, which continue to sow victims, particularly among children, are completely banished." The Pope then turned to a newly created Blessed of the Church, Antonio Rosmini, who was beatified in Novara on Sunday.
Grande figura di sacerdote, e illustre uomo di cultura.
The Holy Father called him a great figure of the priesthood, a man of culture, and a person who had a fervent love of God and of the Church. Following the Angelus, the Holy Father greeted the huge crowd beneath his window in a number of languages, including English.
I offer a warm welcome to all the English-speaking visitors gathered for this Angelus prayer. Today's Gospel urges us to be steadfast in our faith, trusting in Christ's victory and the coming of his kingdom. May we find in prayer the strength to remain always faithful to the Lord and his Church. God bless you and your families.
I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Living out the Christian faith in today's secular society. That was one of the central themes the Catholic bishops of England and Wales were confronting at their autumn meeting in the northern city of Leeds last week. The church leaders had a full four-day programme with some pressing moral issues at the top of their agenda. How to respond to the government's sexual orientation legislation, for example, and how to advise Catholic schools in the wake of Amnesty International's recent decision to support abortion in certain circumstances. Well, to find out more about these discussions, I talked to the head of the Bishops' Conference, Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor.
I think there were four issues of fundamental importance, three very practical ones. We've heard, first of all, the report from Lady Cumberledge and her commission on safeguarding of children, which was a follow-up to our report 6 years ago from the Nolan Commission about child protection, really, but this takes it a stage further, and so we had to discuss that. Very important for safeguarding of children, and also I think the way that the whole of the safeguarding of children is were embraced and taken hold of by the priests and people of our diocese. Secondly, we talked about the adoption agencies, very important indeed, because of the difficulties we've had over a matter of Catholic principle with the government with regarding the way in which our adoption agencies work and our focus on the family, on marriage, as the best place to bring up children. And because of a regulation passed by the government, sexual orientation regulation, it's made it very difficult for us. And thirdly, we had to agree a letter on Amnesty International regarding their decision to uphold the right to access abortion in certain circumstances makes our own affiliation, if you like, to Amnesty rather problematic. And the last thing is, which was very interesting for us, was of course a general discussion led by Archbishop Bruno Forte on the whole question of religion in society today, particularly in our Western society, so secularized. How do we, as believing Christians, as Catholics, take our place and play our part in the secular world of today?
The meeting was very good indeed. It got off to a good start because we had with us Archbishop Bruno Forte, who came to speak with the bishops about religious freedom.
As General Secretary of the Bishops' Conference, Monsignor Andrew Summersgill also attended the meeting in Leeds. He told me the thought-provoking discussions around Archbishop Forte's presentation were a particularly good way to begin the week's work.
It was a look at the way in which the Church can engage with and find itself within a culture which is more and more secularized, and how you answer the real questions that are being put in this whole kind of secular approach to life. And so Archbishop Forte spoke with the bishops, and then a group of academics and theologians from English universities came to join the bishops, and there were a series of seminars followed by a discussion, and it was quite a stimulating exercise.
Is that quite unusual? I mean, normally the bishops get together and talk amongst themselves. Is this departure a little bit unusual, perhaps, and quite stimulating, as you say?
Well, I suppose it is a little bit unusual, but it was felt that it would be a good way to try and just address a very wide subject and begin to help the bishops just to focus on where they would like to place themselves in, their specific role. And one of the ways we thought about doing that was for the bishops to be able to speak with others and just find where their particular role as teachers of the faith and pastors of the Church, where that was situated in this whole context. And I think we will find ourselves just working through that in the next few months as the work of the conference carries on now.
Let's look in detail then at some of those key questions the bishops were facing. In particular, I had some questions for Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor about the Cumberledge report on child protection policy. Certainly in the secular media, the question going to be asked is, well, does this put this whole chapter, this tragic chapter of child abuse in the Church behind us? What's your answer to that?
My answer is that we are absolutely determined as the Catholic community to make our safeguarding of children not only a priority, but also a model for how this particular a need in society, not just within the Catholic community, but everywhere, that ours should be a model of way safeguarding of children is carried out. I should also add that we've included in this report and our response to it not only children, but also vulnerable adults. That's a very important, as it were, addition to the first recommendations we were given 6 years ago.
But what exactly does this report say, and what changes will it bring at the local parish level? Monsignor Andrew Summersgill explains.
Yeah, well, I think in terms of parish life, there are probably two things that it's going to mean. The first is that at the moment, the structures and the processes within the Church focus quite specifically on the protection of children. What the new arrangements mean is that that is expanded from the protection of children to include those who are described as vulnerable adults. And in common with many countries, there is a statutory definition of a vulnerable adult.
Which would mean, specifically?
People who are in need of care and of protection, people who perhaps suffer from mental illness and a whole range of things, really. It's really quite a technical definition. And the word and the concept that is used to be all-embracing in this is safeguarding. So I think that what we will find within parishes as this is rolled out during the coming year or so is that we will talk less about child protection but more about safeguarding, whilst not losing anything of the child protection provision we have, but we will begin to be expanding into that kind of area. And in a sense, it is really, again, it's what we do as Catholics. It's what we do within the church, that we look towards caring for those who are vulnerable. And what this is doing is just putting in the legal and the statutory safeguards in order to ensure that that is situated properly where it should be. I think the other thing that will be noticed more specifically within parishes is that probably some of the processes that we put in place will be simplified, and that it should be a little bit easier to work your way around what can be quite complex areas, particularly when you're dealing with this interface between the statutory and, if I can put it this way, the canonical, the way in which the church is organised. And there's going to be quite a lot of work now to be done on ensuring that those two complement each other with perhaps more clarity than there has been up until now.
As you heard earlier, another key question facing the bishops was how to respond to the government's new anti-discrimination legislation, which obliges adoption agencies to consider placing children with same-sex couples. While reaffirming Catholic teaching on marriage and the family, Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor says church leaders must tackle the difficult question of how to uphold that teaching without compromising the valuable service that Catholic adoption agencies continue to provide.
Yes, it is extremely difficult. First of all, the bishops unanimously, of course, express our desire for the agency to continue their excellent work as Catholic agencies. But also, we unanimously declare that this work is based on the Church's moral and social teaching on the vocation of marriage. Now, those are, as it were, the principles on which we work. Now, this particular regulation seems to cut across this. The government have given us time to try and work out, a solution, and indeed have offered us money to seek ways in which we can uphold our principles as well as, in fact, not break the law. That's taking time, and it's very difficult. But we are going to do our best because we want our adoption agencies to continue. But also, we want to uphold our Catholic teaching that the family, that marriage is the proper way to bring up children.
How much in this debate are you listening also to the voices of the professionals, those who are working at the grassroots in these agencies?
Well, I think that the trustees of each agency and the directors have been very close contact with us in these whole negotiations, and actually they're very worried because for them this is their work, which they do so very well, and they don't want to compromise, and I understand that.
Although we may agree in principle with the church's teaching, as social workers and as community workers we must always be open to, you know, the extraordinary possibility. We can't completely eliminate that. And on the one hand, legislation's trying to say, no, you'll always be open to the possibility. It will always be there as a right for same-sex couples. And the church is saying, no, it should never be there as a right.
Mark Wiggin is chief executive of Catholic Care in Leeds, one of the oldest charities in the north of England, caring for children as well as the disabled and disadvantaged people of all ages and backgrounds. He believes it's vital that church leaders listen to the expertise of committed Catholic professionals as they struggle to find a way forward on this and the many other moral issues of our day.
Well, I think it is important to find the common ground, because if we're not dealing with this issue, we'll be dealing with another issue, whether it's to do with morals, family values, what we can teach in schools, end-of-life issues, care for the elderly, etc. So constantly we are going to be challenged and faced with difficult decisions where professional discernment from largely the laity, committed Catholic laity, who are delivering these services will have to make their professional judgments and discernments. And where we're associated with the church, take into consideration the position of the church, which is respected, but doesn't always in practice fit neatly with legislation and the law. So somehow we've got to work modus operandi for getting through these situations somehow. And we've got to sort of perhaps become a bit more sophisticated in how we, as professionals delivering on behalf of the church, liaise with the church, discern through the church, and at the end of the day, work alongside the church so that we don't have to, which is the worst case scenario, withdraw services and therefore remove ourselves from the real world around us, withdraw services from that world, and therefore we're not in there and in what I would call a modern evangelism. That is, being present in the world, working alongside colleagues of other faith or no faith, but presenting our values alongside theirs and working through these things. Now, if we're getting into sort of black and whites and rights and wrongs, moral positions are all very well, but at the end of the day, you've still got to be, to some extent, balancing these things and working your way through. And it's not a case of losing out to either side. I'm not saying there's got to be a compromise, but there's got to be a discernment of actually better working practices. Although we respected the position of the church, we also had to consider the fact that, you know, these are vital services. At one length, you could say that actually they're very supportive of the church's position, that they are things that contribute to pro-life issues. For example, you know, helping families to have children, ensuring that children with disabilities are not aborted before their birth, that there are options for adoption as one of them to exist. So in a way, by doing one thing, you might be denying something else of equal value to the church.
Let's go back a little bit to the history of adoption agencies in the UK, first of all. I mean, how many roughly agencies are we talking about, and roughly what sort of number of children are you dealing with at the moment?
Well, we're talking about roughly about a dozen agencies in England and Wales. And we're dealing with quite a few hundred children per year. Most of the adoption work that is done in this country is done through the local authorities, but the Catholic adoption agencies have got a very good reputation for a lack of family breakdown, for example, once the adoption has been made. For example, the Catholic adoption agencies have a 3% breakdown compared to perhaps a 25 to 30% breakdown in local authorities, for example. So we're good at what we do. The other thing we're very good at is actually placing very difficult-to-place children. In other words, children with disabilities, children with behavioural issues that are quite difficult to place with families. We seem to find the right families to match up with those children. So we're good at what we do. We perhaps represent perhaps only 10% of the adoption work that goes on in this country, but if that's how you want to measure it. But we are a very significant contributor to perhaps more to the quality of adoption work than to its quantity.
Upholding moral principles again while promoting the church's vital justice and peace work was the issue at the heart of the bishop's discussions on Amnesty International, in particular how to advise Catholic schools which support the work of the organisation. Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor again.
It's a particularly difficult one again because Amnesty International is a very respected group that works for justice, human rights, and many, many Catholics, and in schools as well, and in other organisations, work alongside Amnesty. So we think this is important work, the work of Amnesty, in accordance with the Church's social teaching. But the Amnesty's decision this summer to uphold the right to access abortion in certain circumstances, and therefore compromise the fundamental right to life, I think has put schools, parishes, justice and peace groups in a difficult position with regard to formal membership. And I think schools and parishes might therefore have to consider alternative ways of continuing this important work. So we've sent a letter to schools along those lines. We cannot accord with their decision regarding abortion. At the same time, we've got to recognise that much of their work is very, very good work.
My thanks there to Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, the Archbishop of Westminster, and earlier you heard the General Secretary of the Bishops' Conference of England and Wales, Monsignor Andrew Summersgill, and Mark Wiggin, Chief Executive of Catholic Care in Leeds. breakthrough in Catholic-Orthodox relations, or simply a small step on the long road to Christian unity between East and West? That's the question being posed following publication of the latest Catholic-Orthodox joint document, which examines the questions of authority and papal primacy, one of the key issues which provoked the schism between East and West almost 1,000 years ago in 1054. The document on ecclesial communion, conciliarity and authority was published last Thursday and is the fruit of last October's plenary assembly of the Joint International Commission for Theological Dialogue between the Catholic and Orthodox churches.
Ecumenism is a very serious business, and if we look back over the history of the church and realize how long established, sadly, our divisions have been, it stands to reason that if we're going to address those divisions, it's unlikely we're going to overcome them very quickly and suddenly.
Father Paul McPartlin is a member of that joint commission and professor of ecumenism at the Catholic University of America.
I would say, first of all, that the whole topic of authority, which of course is a vital question in the church and in the relations between the Catholic and Orthodox churches, is set in the document very much within the very rich context of communion. The communion life that the Church has from the Blessed Trinity, especially through the celebration of the Eucharist. And this document begins by giving a very rich portrayal of the communion life of the Church, in which all the baptized share and all the baptized are responsible for maintaining the faith which is given to us by God. And all the baptized care for one another, share with one another, and live a life of communion. And within that life, of course, the Church has its leaders. And that's where the question of authority comes in. And the document stresses then that authority is given by Christ through the Holy Spirit to the apostles and then to their successors, the bishops. And that then this authority is transmitted into the life of the Church. And the Church then falls into a pattern of life. And indeed, the document makes a very rich statement about the Holy Spirit engendering within the life of the Church the structures which accord with its fundamental nature of communion. And so we then move on in this document to look at those structures. And we consider those structures at three levels within the life of the Church. First of all, within the local church, of course, the bishop is the focal point, the protos, which is a word that we use quite a lot in the document, the first, the head, the primate, you might say, in the local church. And then, of course, within a family of local churches in a given region, that's the next level, the regional level, there has from ancient times been the fact of regional groupings of dioceses within the church. And this, of course, gave rise in the ancient church to the patriarchates, and each region would have a patriarch, and he would be the protos, to use that word again, the first. He'd be the head of the church in that particular area, very much amongst the local bishops, and so he would be engaged in a collegial relationship with the bishops in that region. And then, of course, by the same logic, we move to the universal level and think, well, in the universal church, is there likewise a primate, a focal point, a protos, a head? And this document makes the very important statement that we acknowledge together that that structure indeed pertains also to the universal level of the church.
This document then recognizes that the See of Rome, in other words, the Bishop of Rome, has this place of primacy. I mean, it seems like an enormous step forward. Some are even suggesting that we're almost looking reconciliation in the face, but it's not quite as simple as that, is it?
No, it isn't as simple as that. There is a very great deal of discussion that still has to go on. And indeed, we agreed in Ravenna that the topic for the next phase of the dialogue would be the role of the Bishop of Rome in the communion of the Church in the first millennium, the time of the undivided Church, as we say. And then, of course, from then, we will have to go on to consider the role of the Bishop of Rome, presumably, in the communion of the Church in the second millennium, how it was then differently viewed after the schism of 1054. And then we will have to see, presumably, how we might embrace that role for the Church of today. So there is a very long track of dialogue that still lies ahead of us.
But this, I think, is an important starting point, and it's very much a document in which we've established a firm basis for future discussion. There's a solid basis here. We've acknowledged that there is such a thing as primacy at the universal level in the Church, although we say very carefully in the Ravenna Statement that East and West have different ways of understanding this primacy and different ways of justifying this primacy historically and theologically. But the fact of primacy, the fact that there is a protos at that universal level in the Church, is something that we have been able to acknowledge together. And that does mean that we have a very significant common statement there from which we can go on to discuss, well, what sort of protos is this? What sort of prerogatives attach to this office? And of course, as we know, Catholics and Orthodox would have very different understandings that they might want to bring to that discussion.
Significantly, this decision, this document, comes as the Orthodox Church itself is struggling with the question of primacy, with discussions or quite serious differences of opinion between Constantinople and Moscow, for example.
Yes, there were difficulties at the Ravenna meeting because the delegation from Moscow said that they were not happy sitting down to take part in the dialogue if there were delegates there from the Church of Estonia, which is recognized as autonomous by the Patriarchate of Constantinople, but not by the Patriarchate of Moscow. So there were indeed difficulties there, and as Catholics, of course, it's not for us to enter into those difficulties, but simply to say that we're sorry that there are those difficulties, and we hope that they can be resolved. And I think, for me, the existence of those difficulties and those tensions just shows how much both Catholics and Orthodox, we need each other. We urgently need to reestablish the full communion of all the Church together, both East and West.
Significantly also, Pope John Paul II called for Christian leaders to have precisely this discussion of how the primacy can be at service of all Christians, didn't he, in his document Autunum Sint?
Yes, well, that was very much a landmark statement and invitation from Pope John Paul in 1995 in Autunum Sint, and it very much changed the ecumenical landscape because the Pope, with great generosity and great eagerness, placed his own office into ecumenical discussion and said that he wanted to have that discussion. And as I say, that really changed the whole context of discussion about the papacy. It was no longer something that people did and felt that they couldn't actually bring this to the Catholic Church and say what they wanted to say. The Pope himself said, "I want this dialogue." And so, ever since then, there has been a new context, and very many discussions have been going on. Very many symposia, books have been produced. And the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith has also contributed very much to that discussion, saying that the role of the Pope is to serve the unity of the Church, and that in each different age of the Church's life, the Pope will discern how best he can serve the unity of the Church. And that initiative of Pope John Paul in 1995 was itself a wonderful example of responding to the needs of today.
And my thanks there to Father Paul McPartland, Professor of Ecumenism at the Catholic University of America and member of the Joint International Commission for Theological Dialogue between Catholics and Orthodox. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.